Get a concise daily market update from Charles Schwab, including the latest on U.S. and global economic news, stock updates, monetary policy decisions, and key results and statistics that may impact your trading. Schwab Market Update, an original podcast from Charles Schwab, provides an information-packed daily market recap in 10 minutes or less. Listen today at schwab.com/marketupdatepodcast or wherever you get your podcasts.
Intel is the spark for the dreamers who do. They dream of a life with no diseases, of cleaner, greener, more reliable energy, of advancing education by bringing AI everywhere. Intel is the spark to start something new, to know that no dream is too daring when you have the right foundation. It starts with Intel. Learn more at intel.com/starts.
This is the Bloomberg Surveillance Podcast. I'm Tom Keene, along with Jonathan Farrow and Lisa Abramowitz. Join us each day for insight from the best in economics, geopolitics, finance, and investment. Subscribe to Bloomberg Surveillance On Demand on Apple, Spotify, and anywhere you get your podcasts. And always on Bloomberg.com, the Bloomberg Terminal, and the Bloomberg Business App.
Laurie Cavasina joins us now, head of U.S. Equity Strategy at RBC Capital Markets. Laurie, let's just start with the jobs report on Friday. It follows through into Monday, equities lower. What did that change for you, if anything at all?
So, look, I think it's one data point. You know, I think there was a view that emerged over the weekend in Friday trading that the Fed may have to stay higher for longer. We may not get the pause. We may not get the cuts. I'm still in the camp that thinks we are closer to the end of this hiking cycle and we're going to get the pause. And for me, it really underscores the idea that this economy is very resilient. I think there could have been some labor hoarding. You know, I think that there are things that could explain that hot number, but I think we just see this time and time again, just evidence that the labor market is tight and that we are seeing, you know, if you look at some other reports, we're seeing some indications that wage growth is slowing. I think that's probably enough to help inflation come down. So I'm not overreacting to Friday's report. For me, the broader thesis is still intact for now.
Laurie, what I find fascinating, I thought of you this weekend, Bloomberg reporting that Danaher is looking at a service company in the medical field. It's a mid-cap, smaller cap kind of thing. Not a zombie roll-up, but are we just going to see a roll-up in your small mid-cap space because money finally costs something?
I think it's a potential catalyst for markets going forward in the small mid-cap space in particular. So one of the things we know about small cap companies is the quality is higher than it used to be. What we also know is that the price we're going to pay for, you know, either skirting the recession or a short, shallow recession or a growth scare or whatever we end up calling this is probably going to be that economic growth is subpar for a little bit in percentage terms. And I think that incents companies who have a lot of cash still sitting on their balance sheets, who have very good, you know, structures in terms of their debt profiles, I think this is going to incent them to go out and buy some growth. And when you're looking at historically cheap valuations in small relative to large, it's something that simply makes sense. So I think it's, you know, it's something that we have to watch going forward. And I think it argues against a deeply bearish narrative in markets.
At the same time, if you talk about Torsten Slok's narrative about no landing, is that positive for equity valuations if that means higher rates for longer and companies having to justify their capital structures in a much higher rate regime?
I think it depends on exactly what you mean by higher rates. Now, if we're going back to something that we saw in the 70s, of course, that's going to slaughter PE multiples. We actually have a model where we bake in inflation, Fed funds, and also the 10-year yield. And we published an update on that this morning. We do have a couple cuts baked in for the Fed at year end, and it gets us to a 22 times multiple. We also have, you know, the 10-year treasury at around 3.4% and inflation moderating to around 3%. But let's say I just go in, Lisa, and flex those interest rate assumptions and kind of take the Fed number up and just leave it there. So don't bake any cuts and keep that higher for longer. I'm still looking at a 20 plus PE multiple on a trailing basis on this year's earnings. So it hurts a little bit, but it doesn't hurt as much as people think if you go in and do the math.
Laurie, I just want to finish on the rest of the world. China has gone from uninvestable to unavoidable, and then seemingly in the last 48 hours has swung back to something in between. Laurie, how much interest is there from your clients to invest abroad this year?
So it's been huge, John, and we've talked about this in the past, but I think investors came into 2023 just wanting to do something new. And one of the new things that people wanted to do was play the China reopening thesis. And I think raising the geopolitical angst and talking about worsening relations between China and the U.S., I think it complicates the ability to play that trade. So as we sit here and think about things that could push markets down in the short term or cause, you know, things to just lose a little bit momentum, to me, frankly, that's, you know, a more legitimate downside catalyst than say, oh, earnings need to come down a little bit more. I think the market understands the latter. I think the China issue is it's challenging something that had gotten people very excited coming into this year.
Laurie, wonderful. As always, it's good to catch up and kick off the trading week with you. Laurie Cavicina there of RBC Capital Markets.
Right now, Michael Schell joins us, Chief Executive Officer, Market Field Asset Management, with a very, very nuanced note there. How did your view change, the market field view, after 517,000 plus 54,000 revisions? How did the labor economy of the United States adjust your view?
I mean, I thought it was strong, and Friday's numbers told you it was strong. I do think it's one of those reports that looks like a bit of a statistical aberration. It's sort of strong across the board. It's a weird time of year, and you had all of the 2022 adjustments thrown into that. So, you know, I think probably we're still creating about 200,000 jobs a month.
Yeah.
All of the labor metrics look okay. And in Friday's number, particularly in the household survey, you know, you discovered a bunch of the missing jobs that Jay Powell had been talking about, which it's not shocking. I mean, the labor data is strong.
The market field view is a more long-term view. We're now back to where money costs something.
Yes.
How much? Speak to people that have never enjoyed what Michael Schell or Ehrenstein have enjoyed, or speak to how we're back to now where money costs something. How does my life change?
Well, I mean, the question is, are you operating in a kind of business that can generate enough cash flow that money at 5% is unimportant? I think for a lot of the economy, you know, it's really still okay. I don't think the sort of what we would call the sort of old economy has really been devastated by interest rates. I think the problem is much more in people who have been very, very creative with financial engineering attached to a business. And there, you know, which is a lot of a sort of PE VC portion of the economy, there I think 5% is going to matter. I think we're going to be at or around 5% for a while. Frankly, we're going to be at or around 5% until things start to fall apart.
This talk, of course, of going abroad. Only a year or so ago, China was totally uninvestable.
Mm-hmm.
We start 2023, and I'm told repeatedly it's unavoidable. The events of Friday and over the weekend, does it change how we want to be invested in the China story?
Look, I think there's two big issues. One is that the Chinese have switched from, you know, really a very bad COVID policy to a more manageable COVID policy. And monetarily, they've gone from tight to loose. So that's really, really positive. The thing that hasn't changed, and it's been true really since 2018, is the sort of geopolitical aggravation of investing in China. You know, it's not a lot of fun. I mean, we found that out in Russia last year, where everything we had there, which wasn't much, you know, was wiped over a weekend. I don't think China itself is that attractive for those reasons, but that whole region is now much, much more attractive. I think some of the markets surrounding China are investable. I think the Japanese, as a byproduct of yield curve control, have also sort of involuntarily switched to a very loose, monetary policy. So I think Asia and the portions of the U.S. market that feed into that, you know, are suddenly doing quite a lot better.
Does this extend to Europe?
Yeah.
To London, either. The miners listed on the FTSE. Does it extend to them?
You know, the FTSE made an all-time high on Friday.
A record. No one's talking about it.
No one talks about it.
I missed that completely.
Made an all-time high. And it's been struggling, struggling with this level for, you know, since 1999-2000. So it does for that portion of the London market. I think it does for the German economy, which is still tied, you know, which is still tied into that. So I think for, you know, a portion of global economically sensitive equities, the news has got materially better in the last 4 months.
How do you decipher the signal from the noise at a time of such noise, particularly short covering and some of the volatility that we saw last week?
Oh, I think it's really hard. My phone didn't stop ringing like Thursday and Friday last week from people trying to work out what on earth is really going on. Look, some of the technicians I respect think they've seen enough to call this a new bull market. I don't. You know, I think that the change in monetary policy last year still matters. I think that we might be in this really weird situation that an index like the S&P Equal Weight might have finished its bear market last year, but the index we actually follow, which is the headline index, which is dominated by large cap tech, I think is still in a bear market.
I want to build on that and just give this color that Thursday's short covering was the largest since November 15th, according to Goldman's trading desk, to give you a sense of just how violent it really was in a historical perspective. Big tech, you don't think it can recover from here, even with all of the job cuts? Is that what you're saying?
Yeah, I don't think the NASDAQ 100 is going to make a new high in 2023. I'd be shocked if it did.
Why?
Because I think it was grotesquely overvalued when it did make its all-time high. And I think these sort of 10-year bull markets, when they end, take a long time to give you a new high. It doesn't happen in 10 months.
You studied commodity cycles. You mentioned some optimism, Pacific Rim ex China.
Yeah.
This is how I'd put it. Is that enough to get oil above $100 Brent? Is that something that's more probable than many would think?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's got a much better chance of being 160, you know, at $80 today.
I mean, I'm deciding, do I need two barrels in my living room like Lisa had?
No, I don't think it's crazy. But I think you have to realize that the weakness in crude oil prices since last summer was caused partly by what was going on in China, which we assume is getting better. But it was also caused by massive releases from the Strategic Petroleum Reserve. And I think one thing's for sure, in 2023 is we're not going to see that happen again.
They can't repeat the act, that's for sure.
No, they can't. I mean,
Michael Hsiao of Marketfield Asset Management. How can you repeat the act, Tom? They're looking to rebuild the thing.
Get a concise daily market update from Charles Schwab, including the latest on U.S. and global economic news, stock updates, monetary policy decisions, and key results and statistics that may impact your trading. Schwab Market Update is an original podcast from Charles Schwab. Join host Keith Lansford for this information-packed daily market recap, delivered in 10 minutes or less. Listen today at schwab.com/marketupdatepodcast or wherever you get your podcast. That's schwab.com/marketupdatepodcast.
Success is more than the final destination. It's a path you take one step at a time. It's discipline. It's teamwork. And it's the drive and passion inside of us that comes before all recognition. It's what Stifel's been doing for over 130 years. Quietly, yet strategically, Stifel's become one of the fastest-growing wealth management and investment banking firms in the country. Our financial advisors go beyond traditional wealth management to provide clients with direct access to one of the industry's largest equity research franchises and a leading middle-market investment bank. Because success is the drive it takes to keep climbing. The passion to keep investing, the best of each of us made better by the best in all of us. And that is where success meets success. Start your journey at Stifel.com. That's STIFEL.com.
Stifel Nicolaus and Company Incorporated, member SIPC and NYSE.
Right now, this is a joy, and Lisa's going to launch on to other broader U.S. political affairs. But with Julie Norman, who is co-director of the University College of London Center on U.S. Politics, I have to go to her younger academic years of traipsing around the Levant. You have not been, Julie, in the earthquake region directly above Damascus, directly above Lebanon, in that northeast corner of the Mediterranean, but you have been northeast of there as well. Well, it's pretty remote, isn't it?
So it's not a super populated area, Tom, but I wouldn't describe it as remote either. I mean, these are still populated areas, and obviously we've seen that from the death toll that is just climbing as we speak, at least 1,300 people killed. So I would say it's Gaziantep, for example, the closest city to where the epicenter was, is one of the centers where many Syrian refugees were fleeing for a number of years during the core years of the Syrian crisis. So these are areas where many people have already faced extreme hardship in life, forced displacement, have been gathering and are now facing this devastating crisis as well.
Aleppo directly south, and we've all seen the horror of the bomb, the leveling of Aleppo is how I would put it. How does the tension, the terrorism that you follow of the war of there of Syria and various parties, how does that obstruct earthquake relief efforts?
Well, Tom, any time that you have conflict ongoing, when you have a unstable government and governing system, and a place like Aleppo where there has been holdout from rebels, you know, resistance to the state taking back over for obvious reasons, it's very difficult to coordinate any kind of relief. It's one reason that we've seen the group called the White Helmets, which again got a lot of press during the Syrian conflict, have been some of the responders at this. You know, they're really the first to the scene. But in terms of reconstruction, in terms of rebuilding after this, it's going to be tough in places like that, that are, you know, beset with many other challenges, even when there aren't natural disasters.
We'll keep giving updates throughout the morning as we get more on this developing situation, a tragedy where hundreds of people are dying. Julie, there is a question in the morning and the sort of mood about what the relationship between U.S. and China really is on the heels of that balloon that got shot down, the surveillance balloon, maybe the weather balloon. That's what China is claiming. What did you make of the Chinese response to the U.S. shooting down the balloon?
Yeah, so Lisa, it's interesting. I mean, I don't think it was a shock to anyone following U.S.-China that there's espionage going back and forth on both ways. So the fact that there are these kinds of surveillance tools themselves was not the main story as much as it was just the brazenness of having it so visible. And I think it's still unclear with how intentional that was to have it be that visible. Was it intentional across the Chinese government? Was it one part of the Chinese government? Or was this just a complete mess up on somebody's part? I do think it was interesting that China's response initially did seem to be a sort of crisis damage control. It wasn't just sitting back with the popcorn and watching to see how the U.S. responded to this. It really did seem alarmed that this was happening and playing out as it was. Obviously, since then, we've seen some of the usual rhetoric of the U.S. is blowing this out of proportion. You know, this was, you know, unnecessary to shoot down the balloon, these kinds of things. But I think the initial reaction said it all, that something did not go right here. And it put China on the back foot and on the defensive, I think, more than the U.S.
We've been talking this morning, Julia, about what the mood among the populations of the U.S. and China have in terms of an effect on the response from both President Biden and Xi Jinping in China. How much are people looking for Xi Jinping to take a hard stance against the U.S.?
Well, I think there's obviously that look, and there always has been. But at the same time, you know, China is coming out of a really unsteady period, trying to come back after COVID, restabilize the economy. And part of that means coordinating in some kind of way with the U.S. So I think there were at least some in China who were seeing this, you know, the Blinken visit that got canceled, this kind of open communication as, okay, let's at least stabilize things, get things back to some kind of normal. And instead, when you see a crisis like this send things into kind of unpredictable directions, that's not something that those who are just wanting to get back to stability want to see. So obviously there's some support for that tough talk, but at the same time, a sense of we don't want things going off the rails more than necessary either.
Julie, the team here at Bloomberg did a great write-up over the weekend of the F-22. This was Damon Shepard and Tony Capaccio, the F-22 Raptor fighter. They indicated this was the first air-to-air kill by that jet. Julia, made me wonder, what do you think the Chinese learned from how the U.S. responded to this event?
Yeah, so obviously there was going to be watching of that, but I do think it's important that the U.S. is also learning from the technology that they will get from this as well. And that was part of the administration's calculation. You know, we've known from before that China has been able to learn from our aircraft. That was one of the reverse technologies that was seen as a real win for China. And I think the U.S. is trying to see if they can do the same thing with unpacking some of these intelligence apparatuses that they do now have hands on. But you're right. Both sides are always, I think, watching the other to see what are they using, how are they using it, and what can we learn from it to adapt in our own systems.
Hey, Julie, great. As always, thanks for being with us. Just perfect timing. Julie Norman there of UCL.
Sarah Hewen is one of the most interesting people in the economics racket. She's out of Joan Robinson's College, Girton at Cambridge, which is truly one of the toughest admits in the world. She's with Standard Chartered, head of Europe and Americas research. Sarah, what was your first completely overwhelming day like at the University of Cambridge. The heritage of that program is stunning. What was it like your first day in the classroom?
It was fantastic, but I was amazed at how many men were in the lecture hall, to be honest. When I'd been at school, it had been equal women, men, and economics was still very much a male type of subject at that time. Things have changed, of course.
Things have changed a lot, and you've been a real leader on that with your coverage here of Europe and now of essentially the Western Hemisphere of Standard Charter. What is your theme, taking Standard Charter's expertise in the Pacific, of a China recovery, and how will that affect the Sarah-Hewen world?
Well, I think it's pretty hopeful, really. We're looking for growth of 5.8% this year in China, and that's above consensus. But we're pretty confident that we're going to see a real surge in consumer spending. And if we look back at what happened in the US and what happened in Europe in the immediate aftermath of the first pandemic wave, helped, of course, by a lot of government spending, particularly in the US, there was a huge surge, 25% real terms increase in consumer spending from trough to peak in the first 12 months after that first pandemic wave in the US, around 15% in Europe. And I think we're going to see similarly large increases in spending that's going to drive the Chinese economy forward. In terms of what it means for our part of the world, it's great for exporters. It's been a sort of difficult year trade-wise, and we think that there's a lot of opportunities in China this year. Question is, what happens to inflation? There are concerns that we could see commodity prices picking up again. Our own view is that the sort of growth we're going to see in China is not necessarily going to be driving commodity prices substantially higher. It's not going to be construction-led. It's not going to be investment-led, very much a consumer-led, and probably consumer services-led boom.
Meanwhile, people are also looking at resilient labor markets, perhaps helped out by some of the demand from China, but very much domestically driven both in Europe as well as in the U.S. How much dissonance is there between the strong labor markets that we see and this disinflationary push that a lot of people are feeling perhaps has a linear nature?
I think there's a lot of dissonance, because it's true that if we look at the US, if we look at the euro area, if we look at UK, we have strong labor markets everywhere. And certainly here in Europe, there are real concerns about what that means for wages. We're seeing wages rising pretty rapidly in the UK. We have strike action, which is likely to further advance that. And in the euro area, no particular signs yet of wages becoming out of control, but some concern that with the unemployment rate as low as it is, the lowest on record, that it's only a matter of time before you see wages catching up. So that does really question what happens to inflation, particularly the services part of inflation. We know that that's a concern for the Fed, and that Chair Powell has talked about the imbalances in the labor market being potentially a driver of services inflation ex housing. So there is this dissonance between what is undoubtedly a decline in headline inflation and certainly a decline in core inflation in the US, less so in Europe, and what we see, this real strength that we're seeing on the employment side.
What was the big takeaway for you from what we saw on Friday from the labor market report in the U.S. that a lot of people thought was something of a head scratcher just simply because of its strength?
To be fair, there was little to suggest that the labor market is weak in those data. I mean, we had some signs earlier in the week. Layoffs were rising pretty rapidly. We know that a lot of the jobs that have been created are part-time. That said, the work week was up. The employment was strong, whichever measure. And even if you account for seasonal adjustments and the sort of population increase, it's difficult to poke a hole in that data.
Well, and this was sort of the zeitgeist over the weekend, Sarah. So let's cut to the chase and be polite. How did so many people get this wrong? Have you thought about it over the weekend? I mean, it was a shock, wasn't it?
It was. And I think that we have had some signs of the economy weakening. So clearly second half of last year, GDP growth was strong. But if you look at the real spending data, then they were weak for October, November, December. The surveys showing activity pretty sluggish. And until we have that ISM services survey, that looked to be the case across the board. So I think it was a double whammy that we had from the payrolls report on Friday and the ISM services completely reversing out that pretty weak number that we'd had previously. A lot of head scratching over where is the economy going.
Sarah, do you agree with Torsten Slok over at Apollo that we could get a no landing given how strong the data has been?
I question the strength of the data, to be honest. I think we need to see the next couple of months without wanting to sound too data dependent. There is a lot of, there are a lot of questions over exactly what's happening to the labour market. Uncertainty that this degree of strength can persist. And we know, of course, that there can be huge revisions 1 month to the next in the data. Mm. So I'd be tempted to sit back. Let's see what happens over the next month or so before deciding that there's a no landing in sight.
Sarah, thank you so much. Sarah Hewen there, Standard Chartered Bank. Subscribe to the Bloomberg Surveillance Podcast on Apple, Spotify, and anywhere else you get your podcasts. Listen live every weekday starting at 7 a.m. Eastern on Bloomberg.com, the iHeartRadio app, TuneIn, and the Bloomberg Business app. You can watch us live on Bloomberg Television and always on the Bloomberg Terminal. Thanks for listening. I'm Tom Keen, and this is Bloomberg.
The Bloomberg Sustainable Business Summit returns to London on April 25th for a solutions-driven look at the sustainable business and finance landscape, looking at the latest trends in ESG regulations, supply chain innovation and transition finance. Speakers include leaders from CDP, Emirates Environment Group, Seedtrace, COA and more. Summit advisors include City Commercial Bank, Red Sea Global and Schneider Electric. Visit BloombergLive.com/SBS2024 to learn more.